consultants hired to deliver a master plan and facilities plan presented a myriad of options to the Park City School Board yesterday, telling the board and the community that it's up to them now to figure out which ideas get more fully vetted. In the studio to give us an idea where we go from here, I have School Board Member Aaron Grady along with Business Administrator Todd Howard. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Aaron, the board... there were only a couple of questions from board members following the presentation. No real follow-up discussion. Now that you've had a chance to sleep on it, what was your reaction to what was presented yesterday?
You know, I think as a whole board, I think we were pretty excited and happy with kind of the direction that things are going. And like it was said in the meeting, we're just kind of, again, more at the beginning of this process. We have a lot more work to do. And we are really, really interested in hearing the community and constituents' feedback. We need that. So we really hope that we can get people out and give us their opinions.
Yeah, were you surprised at all that the process for finishing the master plan could go on for another year?
No, at the end of the day, I wasn't. And I think it helps us stay more fiscally responsible. It makes us slow down a little bit and make sure that we're staying on the right track for the community and moving forward in the future.
And you certainly weren't part of the last master planning process, but all along we've been told that this master planning process would be different than the one we did 5 years ago. This time it was all about putting education first, not about the facilities. All I heard yesterday was about facilities. So how is this different?
Well, I think Todd might be able to speak a little bit better to that because he's been a little bit more in depth with all the process and the last process.
Sure. So the conversations on this one have been around what are the criteria, what are the values, what are the preferences of the education system that we see here in Park City. So that's been 7 months of conversation to pull all of that together. And not a single building structure or design has been part of those conversations. It's just been the ideals. Where do we want to be? We're at that phase now, or the next phase, if you will, where we now translate that into physical structure. So it may start to look like the last process because we will now translate all of that criteria and preferences and values into the physical spaces that students will learn in. So it's different in that we had that conversation first, and now we'll talk about the facilities as we move forward.
Yeah, and so when we heard that, you know, the number one, and I'm not sure, like maybe this was a steering committee or maybe it was from the community survey, when we talked about outdoor learning, that was like the top theme for whomever. I'm not sure who that was.
It came from the learning leaders.
Yeah. The learning leaders. Okay. So, I mean, how does that fit into, how do we shoehorn that into what we've got here?
So that really has us look at what are the environments around each of our schools. So if we look at a Jeremy Ranch where we have a mitigation plan now put in place to restore our wetlands, we can take advantage of those opportunities just right there in our backyards, if you will, of the schools. And what can we do to improve what's happening at each school site?
Yeah. And I guess other than the updated enrollment estimates, and the fact that the steering committee does not want to see a 5-6 school, rather it favors a 7-8 or a 6-7-8 school. What new information did we get out of this process?
So we have more detailed knowledge of why those preferences are the way they are. Before we were going down a path that had 9th grade in the high school and we were debating what happens with 5-6, and in fact looking at just a 5-6 school itself, that option was like option D, I think, in the presentation, and almost the lowest score. And so our knowledge is we have more information, a better understanding of what those preferences are, and we can move forward in a more positive direction.
As I mentioned, the master planning steering committee meeting today, the lead consultant said that the members would have a chance to speak out about the options that he presented last night. What do you see the steering committee working on today?
I think maybe just delving more in depth kind of what was presented to us yesterday. I think my understanding is that each member of the steering committee actually gets a certain amount of time to actually stand up and talk and really give their thoughts on where the process is and what their thoughts are moving forward with where we landed.
So when and where is this meeting happening?
It is happening at the high school this
at
5:30. I was going to say this evening.
Okay. There was also some discussion, as I mentioned, about a public forum and a survey looking to get more input from the community. Any news about that?
We're still working on the date to hold that so we can get as many people together as we can. So we're trying to find that the best date, and we don't have that just yet.
Yeah. I mean, can we do it more than one date?
We'll have to take a look and see. We'll see how the steering committee comes together with our conversations this evening. We'll look to see what the survey tool will produce. The survey tool will be an excellent way to gather a lot of information. Not everyone can always make it to one of those or two of those meetings, but the survey tool will be one that can be very beneficial.
Yeah. Erin, do you worry about, with summer coming, that this process could really be at a standstill until next fall?
Well, I think that it's a little bit of a reality, right? But I think that if we just kind of get our information up and just kind of keep at it and chipping away, I think that we can keep the process moving forward. But I think definitely with summer coming up, it will slow down the process a tad bit.
Yeah, at one point, the ninth grade would have been moved back into the high school this next school year. So how far off is that a reality?
It's really looking at phasing. What do we do? Where can we move the kids? What options are there actually in the building physically to do that? So we just need to look really hard and at those options and see which ones can come together, whether we want to tighten up the classroom spaces. Do we want to put portables out there on a short-term basis? I mean, it's really just what things compel us to make that happen sooner than later.
And as you know, there were extensive architectural plans drawn up in 2015 to expand the high school. Are those still viable plans, or do we need to start over to incorporate this 21st century learning idea?
I think they create a great basis to begin the next conversations. It could be very simply, yep, we're good with those plans, let's move on them. Or it could be, you know, they're not quite exactly fitting the ideals that we had put together. What can we tweak on those? And tweaking's a little less expensive than going from the ground up.
Yeah. Is it a given, Todd, that we do have to bond to do any of those options that were presented yesterday?
So some of the options don't necessarily require bonding. If we're looking at keeping all of our elementary schools online and we're looking at just smaller expansion, say we go to the one of the models where we're bringing the sixth grade back into the elementaries, that would require remodeling. I know that the consultants spoke of having to put a fifth elementary into the system, but that's one option. That's not the only one. You know, if we go down one that's just remodeling, we have money in reserves in our capital fund. Those might be able to cover the cost of a remodel at each of the elementaries to bring sixth grade back. So it really depends on what options advance through these next conversations.
Yeah, and if we keep Treasure Mountain, then, I mean, we don't necessarily need a new middle school, or it can be used as a high school. So
sure,
it could be done without a bond, I mean, right?
To some degree. I can't guarantee that that's the path we'll end up on. It may be that we don't do a bond. Maybe we would look at a tax increase for a short period of time and we take care of it on a short-term basis on our own. You know, it's the options are all out there right now.
Yeah. And again, we're not going to hear any of those price estimates until we really know what we've got, right?
Yeah, we want to get down to the two or three ideas that are definitely top of the pack, and then we'll say, okay, what's the cost to do that?
Otherwise, we're just spending more money.
Correct.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention about the master planning process?
Again, I just think that we are really looking for community feedback here moving forward, so please, I just can't encourage that enough. Let us hear your voice. We want to hear them.
Right. I mean, now instead of later, because that's what we saw happen kind of with the last process. Yeah?
Absolutely. And there, beyond the survey, if you need to reach out to anybody at the district office and to any of the school board members, our information is all on the website. And please, we encourage.
Okay. Budget discussion yesterday, Todd, coming in at what, about $80 million?
Yes.
Yeah. And the expected $5.7 million tax increase is on target, so we'll see our property tax line item go up?
Yep, just a little bit. It works out to be about $11 per $100,000 of taxable value, so on the target that we were looking at.
You know, you had mentioned that the impact to taxpayers is half the pain, so what do you mean by that?
I'm trying to remember what I said.
Well, you know that the $11 per $100,000 is lower than what we paid this time around?
Oh, so the tax increase last year was also $5.6 million, but the assessed valuations were lower at that time, so the impact was about $23 per $100,000. We're anticipating assessed valuations to grow a little over 6%, so that spreads the tax burden, if you will, across more value, and so it has reduced it down to the 11.
Yeah, I mean, and we've heard, you know, that there's so little growth, so where are those assessments coming from? Just more valuable?
Yes, yeah, the properties themselves have more value, whether it's because there is less inventory available that pushes the prices up as people want to come and live in our community, as well as there are some new projects that have come online.
You had said that the district is forecast to come in under budget for the current school year. So does that mean that you can roll money over what into the capital fund?
So it rolls over into the M&O fund. And so that was built into the budget. It's a little under $400,000 that we're expecting to come in under budget. So that helps build this next budget and reduces the tax increase.
And what are those savings from?
So the savings come from a number of places. Some of it comes from what we call turnover savings. So we might have built the budget on a certain staffing, and some of those people may have left in the course of the year, or they're not going to be returning next year, and the person that replaces them come in at a lower cost because they'll be lower on the salary schedules. So it's those types of changes in turnover. And then we also have what are called vacancy savings. So in the course of the year, someone may be left, and we hired someone in the course of the year, and they came in at a lower cost. So it's those types of savings.
Okay. Let's see. In terms of how will teacher contracts impact future budgets? Do we now then have the cash then to pay those increased salaries? Or does that mean we're going to have to dip into the rainy day fund?
So we don't anticipate having to dip into the rainy day fund. That's the purpose of this second tax increase in 2 years. So we will be able to maintain the salary schedule as it's built, the commitments that the board has made to compensation increases. Negotiations will be starting up next, the year following this school year, because the three-year contract comes to its conclusion. So we'll have new conversations and new expectations and desires.
You had mentioned to me off air that you're headed down to the legislature for some meetings to talk about school formulas. Anything scary there?
Oh, well, there's always something scary when the legislature gets together. Now, so this is the State Board of Education has put together a task force that includes legislators, school officials at the state level, local school officials, superintendents, business administrators, charter school leaders. And the intent is to go through each of the formulas of public education and make sure that there is equitable treatment within each of the formulas and that the formulas are meeting the desired outcomes of each of the programs of public education. So it's a huge lift. We're going to look at $4 billion worth of funding formulas for the state and try to determine how they can be improved.
Okay. Aaron, back to the agenda. The superintendent read a statement or maybe her report yesterday about standards-based grading. Is that somewhere online that people could read for themselves what she had to say about it?
I don't believe it is online, but I bet it is something we'll
need to get it online.
Sure, we can get it on Board Docs and load it up. I thought it was a great statement. She read all these amazing accolades about the students here in the district, and then talked also about the standard-based grading.
Okay. And this, again, we're kind of implementing this district-wide. It's just at a couple of schools now. Four people gave public input talking about the change. So is it the case that teachers are very supportive and it's students and parents who are concerned about this?
I think that there is a little bit of concern that has come from students and parents. And I think overall, it's just making sure, and I think that was spoken to quite a bit last night, is our communication and making sure that we're communicating properly to our students and parents with the implementation plan. But this is something that is not new. It has been in Ecker for quite a few years, and it's been within our district for I think almost close to a decade of our teachers using some form of standard-based grading or learning. So that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah. So is it just a few parents, or is it an overwhelming number that you're hearing from?
No, I don't think it's an overwhelming, but we definitely have heard some voices out there. And then on the contrary, we've heard some really great things. And again, we heard those last night coming from parents also.
Yeah. Are all of the teachers on board with this then?
I think there are some teachers that are on board. I don't know if all of them. And I think that was something we spoke to a little bit last night, too, is making sure that we understand where all of the teachers stand with this moving forward and getting all the teachers the proper training moving forward that they feel like they need.
Yeah, well, we heard from Board President Andrew Kaplan, who said that the board is listening and will consider all of the comments and concerns from parents, students, and teachers. Is it fair to say, though, that the plan for standard-based grading system is moving ahead and that the board and superintendent just want to hear from people, but this is going to happen?
I think it's definitely something that is moving forward for sure, and it is something that we want to hear from. But I think I encourage all of our constituents, if you have questions or concerns, start with the teachers. Go to the admin at the school level, and if you need to, contact Dr. Gilday. She is more than welcome to sit down with parents one-on-one.
Well, I think that's what she said yesterday.
It is absolutely what she said.
It's kind of like bypass the teachers and go right to her is what I kind of heard.
So, but yeah, I mean, whatever, but we definitely want to hear from you if you have concerns.
Okay. Anything else on the agenda that you wanted to bring up or anything else going
on? No, thank you so much. It was great to actually see you last night there. And again, as we move into master planning, please, I just encourage everybody to get their voices.
Okay. Erin Grady, Todd Halber, thank you for your time. 8:32 now, good morning. Well, the Park City Council meeting tomorrow in a studying session starting at 4:10. Here with a preview, I have City Manager Diane Foster along with Planning Director Bruce Erickson, and Luke Carton is our Sustainability Manager. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, get you all up here on the microphones. Real quick, Diane, the Public Art Advisory Board annual update. Anything in particular that the council wants to see happening that you may not be seeing happening with this, or?
I think in general you're going to see the council be really pleased with the progress it's been making. As a board, it's difficult. They're an advisory board, yet they have a laundry list of stuff to do. So they've gone ahead and done a temporary Olympic Legacy project. They've got, if you go to the PC Mark, local artist Mike Wong has a terrific installation called Gravity and Gear. The China Bridge, I love the China Bridge art, and I love that it tells me what level I'm on. So there's a lot that's been done. There's a lot that's on their agenda. They're working on everything from the McPolin Tunnel to Lucy the Moose and the Bear Bench Walkway. We've got capital projects. We put 1% towards of capital projects towards art, and so they're working on a water treatment project. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot coming up, and I think probably the most exciting thing for the Public Art Advisory Board will be their role in the Arts and Culture District in the future.
Okay, and then Luke, wanted just to ask you quickly, we've been reporting this morning that despite our efforts to be carbon neutral in the next 3 years, a short report was put into the council packet this week showing that our footprint is headed in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so really quick, this deals with the city operations footprint, so this focuses on our 2022 goal, and there's always pluses and minuses. This one's actually really interesting. So we're actually coming back to council. We wanted to give the overall numbers to increase transparency, and we're coming back and we're going to break it down into water, how we move around, so both transit, fleet, and then also our employee commuting, and then also our buildings and facilities. The quick high-level pieces, though, is, believe it or not, the increase was most of it was expected. There were a couple, there's always these weird blips that are out there. Couple examples to give. Our bus routes. We added looking back to last year, we added both the white and black. They were in full operation. The really interesting thing about that is using the Electric Express, the white route. If we would have done that with diesel, we would have burned almost 98,000 gallons of diesel on top of that, which would have increased our carbon footprint by even more, by almost another 10%. So there are some interesting pieces to dive into this. The reason we're coming back with the water piece, the fleet piece, and also the facilities piece is we want to break it down, because the water side, we actually view it as we're potentially going to be increasing our energy use over the next few years because we take Three Kings offline. We have to change our sources, how we select it. So we're running everything through Quinns, and we have to pump all around. So we want to kind of give folks, you know, the carbon footprint's a good snapshot, but we also want to give folks both the mitigation on where we're being proactive, everything from, you know, electrifying our bus fleet, the water conservation pieces, the energy conservation we have, but also to be transparent too. We have some strange outliers, great examples. City Hall's not performing as well it should on the energy side, and we think it just needs a tune-up. Just like you take a car in for a tune-up, you know, the building was built very efficiently, but just like your car, you need to bring it back in and tune it up. So we're going to be diving into those as well. But we wanted to get the numbers out there and tell people, hey, this is hard. But the other thing is the good thing is we have mitigation plans for most of these things, and we'll be reacting to some other issues as well. But overall, it's no major cause for the concerns. Like I said, there's a couple of facilities that are strange outliers. But as the city increases, you know, our transit service, and we look at increasing ridership. Those do have impacts on our carbon footprint. But the great thing is we have ways to mitigate that. As using transit example, we're electrifying. We're actually this summer we'll be signing our RFP for 100% renewable piece to power all of those buses off electricity as well. So there's pluses and minuses. It's just we wanted to get the numbers out there, and then we're going to do deep dives in three topics.
Okay, so when are you going to have some more of that?
Starting in May. Yep, we're going to start with we have the water, we have the moving around piece, and then we also have the buildings and facilities side too. And it's really interesting to kind of understand, especially the reason we're doing the water one specifically is because that is a very complex system, and they have multiple sources. And the interesting thing is we work with other water agencies on that too. But the thing is, we want to also use this as a term to educate people of where we view the water energy use is going. What you're funding through your energy efficiency dollars, like our JSSD pipeline, that's going to reduce one of our water bills by at least 30%. Kind of the plans for the Three Kings. So we want to kind of show people the comprehensive plans for these kind of three major areas that are summed in the staff report. And people... If you can get confused by scope 1, 2, and 3, but we wanted to break it down by kind of major business units. And then also talk about and be honest and transparent about the areas we don't have solutions for yet. The two big ones are plow fleet and our police fleet. They're just really hard to figure out, and we're going to keep researching, but we again want to let people know that we have solutions for some things and not solutions for everything.
Okay, well, you sound optimistic, but should we be that optimistic?
You know, I think we need to be. But I truthfully believe that, you know, as we deep dive into these three areas, that there are some really good pieces to pull out. Another great example on the facility side is, you know, as the full acquisition of the New Arts and Culture District came through, you know, we actually, you know, look at the old clinic that used to be that Mountain Trails is in now. So, you know, that is a part of our carbon footprint now that wasn't before. Now that building is going to be going away in that side of it too. So it's a much deeper story than just the numbers. And instead of trying to bury people with a 80-page report, our response is, hey, these are the areas that we know we're doing well on. These are the areas that, hey, there's some issues that we need to respond to. Like I said, the City Hall piece is a good example. And then here's the issues we don't have answers for, like our plow fleet. So we wanted to kind of walk people through, and it helps kind of lay out the plan over the next just few years to get us to our 2022 goals for city operations.
Well, as I mentioned, we'll bring you back so that we can do more of a deep dive with that. Thanks for your time this morning. And Bruce, let's turn to you. There is the council will be hearing an appeal of a decision made by the Historic Preservation Board. It denied an aspect of a proposed remodel to a home on historically significant home on Woodside Avenue. Basically, the HPB says that the remodel doesn't comply with the LMC requirements, the Land Management Code requirements, and it would compromise the historic integrity and would have adverse effects. The appellant, though, says it's hard to believe that 35 square feet and 13% of a roof could have such an impact. So that's the decision the council needs to make there?
That's the decision the council has to make. And let me see if I can undo the jargon. Obviously, I'm not Planner Tyler, who's very good at this. But this one has been a strange one. It's on 424 Woodside Avenue. And this is one of the original historic houses that actually faced east and not to the west on that side of the hill. And so the front of the house faces Main Street. It does not face Woodside. So that was issue number one, when we had to kind of figure out which way the front of the house fit. And then two, in the 80s and 90s, there was an addition put on that looks like an 80s and 90s condominium attached to the building. And then the house was kind of allowed to be a rental unit that wasn't particularly well managed. Now what they're asking to do is to remodel the building. The Historic Preservation Board has said, yes, you can relocate the building to protect it from the snow removal of the street, but you cannot turn it around. That was a decision that was made several months ago. And now the decision is whether they can remove, as you say, 13% of the historic roof to do the connection between the existing other building and the new historic structure. Excuse me. So it's very complicated, very technical. The Historic Preservation Board decided that the removal of this particular portion of the roof was not acceptable and decided to recommend for denial. The appeal goes to the City Council, and the City Council will decide whether or not this is an appropriate action on this historic house.
So staff, I understand, recommends upholding the Historic Preservation Board's denial?
At this point, yes. Staff recommended originally that the addition was acceptable to the Historic Preservation Board. Historic Preservation Board, in their authority, said, no, it's too big. It's not going to work. So in this particular case, the staff is elected to support the Historic Preservation Board recommendation of the City Council.
Okay. I don't know if this is your issue as well, but we've got a lot next to the city cemetery there on Monitor Drive. And it was approved for a small office building, I believe. The owners now want to bring back a multi-family unit development, residential?
Right. This one is called the Black Bear Development. And back in the early 80s, there was a long controversy about how this parcel got there, if you will. It's next to our little pumping station. It's behind the cemetery. It's behind the condominiums there. There's some access issues. But over the course of a number of meetings with the Planning Commission, the neighborhood decided they did not want the traffic going through their neighborhood that would be created by residential housing. So they said, okay, we'll put a deed restriction on this to do a professional office building, and that'll reduce the number of trips in off-hour periods. So the deed restriction restricts it to a professional office similar to Park Meadows Plaza across the street. They're requesting the city to remove that deed restriction. At this point, we're reviewing the proposal, but we're looking for some public benefit out of it.
Does the city made a decision that an office building makes more sense? Or, I mean, sure, there's the vacancy rates are non-existent, but I mean, in terms of, there's also an opportunity here to put some cheaper multifamily housing.
Well, I think that that's the missing component of the proposal from the applicant, is just exactly what it is that you want once the deed restriction goes away. At this particular point, the application is only to remove the deed restriction.
Okay. So no guarantees of what would be built there afterward. Okay. So is there a recommendation then not to remove the deed restriction?
At this point, yes. Okay. Until we know more about what the applicant's position is.
Okay. And then we're also presenting the plat amendment for Woodside Park Phase 1. Is this so that we can sell these?
Yeah, this is so that we can clean up the property lines on Woodside Park Phase 1 and put everything to bed out there. This is standard subdivision work. It's not the same as Woodside Park Phase 2.
Okay. KPCW also on the council's agenda, and council voting whether to allow for a plat or a condominium amendment to expand our studios. I was going to ask you, Di, I mean, do we have a quorum for this? I mean, given that most, if not all, of the council members have financially supported KPCW at some time or other, I mean, do they have to recuse themselves from this?
So donations, and I did check with legal on this, donations to nonprofits are generally not the basis for recusal. And so we have every reason to expect that there'll be action as we have on prior plats, and council members would disclose any personal interests accordingly.
Okay. And Bruce, in terms of what KPCW has proposed, planning staff's okay with it?
Planning staff has approved it. The Planning Commission has recommended approval to the City Council. It's a very, very complex black box on how we're going to do it. It looks more complex than what it needs to be to get you some additional space, but basically another 900 square feet of additional office building to get KPCW into the 21st century.
And what people are going to see is the building cantilevered towards Sweet Alley and also down Sweet Alley.
It'll cantilever about out to where the existing stairway is. The existing stairway will stay in place, and then to the west, it will go out to the sidewalk, but will not cover the sidewalk. So all our walkability efforts and Sweet Alley efforts will remain in place, and you'll be able to expand.
Okay, and does anybody know what the latest is with the Kearns Tunnel? We had kind of heard that this was going to be...
The Kearns Tunnel is going in front of the Planning Commission on the 24th for an update. City Council's already approved the construction contract. So we're just going to quickly brief the Planning Commission about it and make sure they understand that improvement. We expect it to happen this year.
And council, and as Bruce said, they approved the contract on the 14th of March, so just 4 weeks ago. And construction is not scheduled to start until school is done. We don't want to interrupt the students, and it is expected to be completed mid-August prior to the start of school.
Okay, it's not going to, because we had heard at one point maybe done for at least walkable for graduation. But
no. Yeah, we don't, you know, we don't want to interrupt traffic in that corridor while school is still happening.
And now that the snow's melted, we've seen how badly the project along Prospector Avenue has been left. Is that going to get fixed?
So is this one me or you, Diane?
I can take this one quickly. Right. Just Corey Legg has done an amazing job on this project, and they did suspend work on it specifically because of the season. And so this is coming back in, and this is the right time to plant. You don't want to do the pieces that we've done in the rest of Prospector that time of year. They're, you know, everything from, we've got 12-foot lane widths there, so we've made the lane smaller. We've got a multi-use pathway. There are, in some places, 8-foot wide, in other places, 5.5-foot wide. There are new LED lighting fixtures. It just, I drove through it last night specifically just to kind of say, how's it looking? And it looks so much better than it used to look, even though the landscaping's not done, and we're pretty excited about the landscaping. The other piece that's mentioned in the staff report that we will be bringing back to council is we have received a formal request from the Prospector Square Property Owners Association to take over their landscaping, and that's an increased level of service, and that's something that the city council would need to approve. We think the cost is de minimis. I think staff believes it's probably a good idea, because then we get to pick the plants, and we'll put in things that are more drought tolerant, water wise, etc. But that'll be a future council decision.
Okay, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Park City Manager Diane Foster with Sustainability Manager Luke Carton and Planning Director Bruce Erickson. And you're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, last week, the Utah Foundation released a report detailing teacher pay and how Utah stacks up with the rest of the country. The report was authored by Sean Deegan. He's an analyst with the Utah Foundation. Good morning to you, Sean.
Hey, good morning.
And did I get your last name right?
Sean Tigan.
Tigan, okay.
Pretty close.
Okay. First, if you just would, tell us who the Utah Foundation is, what you do, and how you're funded.
Yeah, so Utah Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. We work on public policy issues, like a lot of different governmental issues, such as taxation and transportation and education and the environment and a whole host of different things. And we are funded primarily from our big supporters, who are typically also our board members. So we've got about a 65-person board. These are organizations that range from nonprofit entities to banks to large industrial organizations, to engineering firms, and kind of cities and towns across the spectrum, really.
Yeah. You do a great job on the reports that you do put out. I mean, is it the board then that decides what issues will be tackled in these reports?
They decide kind of what the main broader scope of the reports are going to be, and then the research itself kind of directs what we're going to focus on. When we start researching an issue, we kind of find where the research leads us, and then thus far the board's been pretty happy with what we released. So they basically give us some broad brush strokes on what they'd like us to focus on, and then we just kind of let it take us to where it directs.
Okay. Well, the title of this report is Apples to Apples, How Teacher Pay in Utah Stacks Up with the Competition. So in terms of teacher pay, who is Utah's competition? Is it the rest of the country here, or are we just talking the Mountain West?
You know, in some ways, neither one of those. But we talk about teacher pay in terms of national averages, and we talk about teacher pay in terms of the Mountain West. But really, I think the main competition is just simply other jobs and other industries and other sectors, and that's basically a competition for great people that are working in that are in the workforce, and part of what we find is that You know, it depends on how you look at teacher pay, but you know, we do all right compared to the national average in Mountain States. If you're looking beyond the averages, like in terms of averages, we're lower, but that's partially because of levels of experience. We're a growing state; we have a lot of new teachers, and so they're bound to be paid less. But we're probably somewhere in the middle in terms of national and Mountain States comparisons. But when you look at like other industries, when you look at people that have similar credentials, that have similar levels of experience, teachers then earn quite a bit less.
Yeah. So what did you find? Is that the average Utah teacher earns almost $48,000, and that compares to what?
The average Utah teacher earns about $48,000. That compares to about $60,000 nationwide. And then again, averages, when you look at averages in the Mountain States, Utah's in the back. But when you look at levels of experience and degrees, and just comparing us to the Mountain States, our neighboring states plus Montana, we're actually right in the middle. Starting wages, you know, we're pretty comparable to other Mountain States. And even people with 15 years of experience were pretty comparable to Mountain States. So, you know, our neighbor, and this is probably a bigger deal for people in Summit and Rich counties and maybe Daggett, is that Wyoming actually pays quite a bit more. Wyoming is top of the Mountain States and really up there in terms of national averages as well.
Yeah, and I you said that Utah is down there. Utah was, I think, lowest, no?
Well, in terms of, if you look at averages, if you look at averages, like let's say with the Mountain States, Utah is at the bottom. But that is due in part to the fact that we have a lot of new teachers. If you look at us compared to Montana, for instance, you know, Montana is somewhere near the median state. But Montana doesn't have a growing population like we have, and so they're not really struggling with as many teachers. They're growing, and you know, most of the West is growing, except for really New Mexico and Wyoming. But they're not struggling to find quite as many teachers as we are and as Colorado is, because they're not growing so quickly. And we have a need to bring a lot of new teachers into the profession, and those new teachers bring down the average because, you know, starting salaries are lower than when somebody's been in the profession for 15 years or so.
Yeah, and it was just this week that I saw another report that shows schools are finding it increasingly difficult to attract and retain staff, especially here in Utah as we grow, and teachers leaving their schools and the profession at rates higher than other professionals and other occupations. And to compound that, fewer people entering the teaching profession than we've seen in recent years. So do you think this study can help bolster that, given the need for teachers?
You know, I think what we try to do is we try to provide people with information. And one of the things we find is that, you know, there is a real decrease in four-year teacher training programs. So the four-year institutions, higher ed institutions, putting out teachers, there's a decrease there. And so you need to find teachers somewhere. And the key that we're really trying to get across here, the point we're trying to get across, is that if you want to have highly effective teachers enter the profession and you want to have these highly effective teachers stay in the profession, you need to do something. And competition with these other industries is a big deal. And one big thing you can do is focus on salaries. And that is something that really shows when you're talking to people who have left the profession and when you're talking to future teachers who are now in college, one of the things they talk about is, you know, the problem is pay. If pay isn't high enough, then you know, I'm going to go somewhere else and see if I can support my family through a career that's going to pay me the kind of wage that I'm going to be able to live on. And, you know, that's certainly a big deal all across Utah, but Park City and even Wasatch County and the rest of the Summit are finding that's really a big deal. You know, Park City, for instance, Park City's got the highest pay in highest starting pay and average pay in the state, but the Park City School District is also struggling for teachers just because it's also somewhat expensive to live in Park City and somewhat expensive to buy a house. So even with the far higher wages for teachers in Park City, that still doesn't really get you into a mortgage and a permanent living situation.
Yeah, and that was certainly what I had made a note of. I mean, were those considerations factored in? I mean, are you just strictly looked at salaries?
We looked at salaries. We also looked at cost of living. But when you're accounting for cost of living, Park City may be 40% higher for a starting salary than some of the lower districts in the state, but that still isn't going to get people to the difference in cost of living between Park City and maybe Paiute County. As you well know, the average sale price of a home in Park City is sometimes two, sometimes three times higher than the rest of the state. And if you have a bump in salary that's $13,000 higher a year, that $13,000 isn't going to pay for that potentially $800,000 house.
Okay. So what is Park City's starting salary for new teachers?
Just under $51,000. And then when you look at Wasatch, it's just over $38,000. The median in the state is just under $38,000. So Wasatch, right around the median, Park City quite a bit higher. But again, when you're comparing teacher salaries to other careers, they're typically about three quarters the pay. And that's a big deal. Like if you're trying to raise a family and trying to put down some roots and buy a home, that's 25% of income is a big deal.
Yeah. What about North Summit and South Summit, two other school districts in the Summit County area?
Yeah, they're also higher than the median in the state. North Summit is South Summit and North Summit are pretty similar. They're also right around $38,000 a year for a starting salary. And then with master's degrees, you get closer to not quite closer to $45,000. And then a master's degree in Park City, you're up over $55,000. But again, cost of living. And, we talk about the cost of living in Park City. If you look at the Wasatch County and the school district there, homes are really increasing in value in that area, too. And even with a slightly above median wage, I think for a lot of teachers would find that if there's not a second income and a good second income in the house, that they'd probably be priced out of a lot of the homes in that area as well.
Yeah. All right. The report is available on the website. Is that where people can go for more information?
Yes, that report and a whole bunch of other education reports and tax reports and a whole host of things are at utahfoundation.org.
Okay. Sean, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.